Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at GBC, and for the next half hour or so, your host, as we look at three big questions. And we do have some big questions this week. On Sunday, we continued our series in Romans. We're in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. In fact, we included chapter 2, verse 1, because chapter 1, 18 to 32 is Paul's description of a disordered world, in which he also includes a condemnation, a description of disordered sexuality, in particular focused on same-sex relationships. So you can imagine that there is at least one big question around that, and there is. I took a little bit of time at the start of that sermon just to address the very simple fact, that this is remarkably complicated. Complicated by our political views and scientific advances, and amplified by social media and changes in our society that are based on philosophical changes that have taken centuries and whatnot to kind of infiltrate and make themselves really felt. There's just all sorts of stuff that goes into these conversations, and they're really difficult to have in there are conversations that should be had as conversations. And so I'm aware that whether it's a sermon on Sunday where, you know, I was the only person who kind of got to speak in that situation, or the Big Three podcast where, again, I'm the only person who gets to speak, really, even though the questions have been raised by others. I'm just aware that that's not necessarily the best forum for conversation, obviously. And that was part of what we dealt with. The passage itself, if I can just kind of touch base on that, because the questions don't really arise from the place of the text in its overall argument. But it's worth just noting that Paul's concern is not so much to describe a disordered world for the sake of describing a disordered world. He wants to ground this in the experience of the Christian community. And so chapter 2, verse 1 kind of flips the tables a little bit and accuses the community of faith, shall we say, of being judgmental within the community of faith, and not necessarily about the outside world in that sense. And just grounding this idea that, you know, Paul's description of the disordered world is essentially what we needed saving from, and that common salvation from a common enemy that influences and impacts and disorders Jews and Gentiles in the context of his letter, that is part of the basis for our unity together. Excludes the basis for judging, as we'll see next week in particular. However, the questions that were raised were more focused around the matters of human sexuality. And so the three that I'm going to try to focus on today are these. In Romans 1:32, if Christians do not speak up about what is evil behavior, are we not guilty of giving approval by default? Sins of omission, so good men do nothing. So chapter 1, verse 32 is that, just kind of summarizes his statement that these people know that they, the people that Paul has been describing somewhat vaguely, that they know that all the deeds that he lists, and there's quite a few of them, deserve death, but they keep doing them, and they approve of people who do. So what's our role as Christians in speaking out against those sorts of things? And that's a good place to start. Secondly, given the Bible's teaching that all wrongdoing is sinful and worthy of death, why does the church often single out sexual sin for special condemnation? And I think that's worth exploring a little bit before we come to the third question, which is, does Paul's teaching in Romans 1:26-27, that's the key piece about men and women in same-sex relations, as we would describe it now. I'm not sure that's the term that Paul would have used, but nonetheless. Does Paul's teaching in that passage mean that all homosexual sexual activity is wrong, even if it's in the setting of a committed monogamous relationship? And I'll try to do all this in our regular time. We'll see how we go with that. But let's make a start. I want to try to, I suppose, build a little bit from broad general reflections through to something obviously a little bit more specific. And so I wanted to begin with the question about Romans 1:32. If Christians don't speak up about what is evil behavior, are we not guilty of giving approval by default or sins of omission? And I know the question doesn't specify sexual sin, but given that that's what the other questions are really focused on, I'm going to try to focus a little bit on that, because I think for me, one of the things that the church universal has not done particularly well is speak out in ways that are helpful against behavior that we don't think is right. And that, of course, has become much more complicated because our society is increasingly secular. When the church was at the very heart of society, it was a little bit easier, and to some degree, not just easier, it was expected that the church would speak out on things that were immoral or whatever the case might be. And there was an expectation and anticipation that the state would kind of support and back those sorts of things, right? So there's been we're in the post-Christendom era, right, where that separation of church and state has become much more stark than perhaps it has almost ever been, really. And so speaking then into our social setting where we no longer have a shared set of values is really quite tricky for us, I think. Well, for anyone, really, if you want to speak out about something. And it's more and more difficult to do that from the perspective of faith, right? Because if I'm arguing from the perspective of faith and our society is thinking about it not in the perspective of faith, then we're kind of talking about, trying to compare apples and oranges. So I think one of the issues around, and we'll pick this up a little bit later on, I think one of the issues about the church's response to shifting sexual mores and shifting sexual ethics is that we as Christians have often been caught talking morality, which I think is appropriate, but talking morality to a society that is no longer listening in moral terms. And so that means that our rationale, our reasoning is, it doesn't land quite the same anymore, right? Saying that something is immoral or ungodly, it doesn't sit in our society, doesn't kind of make as much sense in our society. And so I think that part of the challenge for us as Christians, we want to be, I think we want to be a little bit vocal about the things that we believe are not right. But I think we probably have to work a little bit harder to do some, I would almost call it translation work, to translate the language of morality into the language, or transpose it into a key that our society understands. So I think I may have mentioned this before. I can't remember where or when or whatnot, but there's a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution by a lady named Louise Perry. It was a fascinating read because she ends up defending what we might call a traditional sexual ethic. But she does so from like evolution and from the perspective of human physiology, never once mentioning faith or morality, just kind of laying it out and saying there's a reason why traditional sexuality works and here's why. Doesn't talk about it from the perspective of faith. And I read the book and I thought to myself, I would broadly agree with her conclusions, but I wouldn't have gotten there from the same starting point. So finding that kind of common ground and being able to speak about what's happening in our society and being able to say we don't think it's great, but trying to do so in a way that is speaks the language of our society, translates the biblical and scriptural and theological language into terminology and whatnot that people can understand, I think is a really important part, because we end up sounding really harsh, we end up sounding really dogmatic, and we end up sounding really irrelevant. Not because the questions of sexuality are irrelevant, they are certainly relevant, but because we're speaking in a language that our society doesn't hear anymore. Like, I've, you know, this is just a week and a half after the scandal at the Swans, and I found it really intriguing that it's a scandal. That's the description of it. And it is a scandal, that's for sure. I found it fascinating that the discussion has been about the fact that their behavior breached their code of ethics or behavior. And I'm like, really? Is that all? Can't we just come out and say that it's immoral? That the activity that they engaged in was just, it was fundamentally wrong. While some people will kind of go that way, I think we have to try to find a way to talk about those sorts of circumstances, those sorts of issues, in ways that make some sense for our society. So I think, I hope that's not abusing that question too much. I think that there are times and places for us to speak up against behavior in our society. I think the way we do that, I think, is the critical piece. And the church has tended, the stereotype of Christians is that they're homophobic, or we're homophobic. Now, some of that is the reduction of any ability to have a debate, and it all has to become, it has to be something you can put on Twitter in, 100 characters or whatever it is. And that certainly diminishes your ability to provide nuance, right, or context and those sorts of things. However, we do tend to come across that way sometimes. And part of it, I think, is because we haven't done quite enough work to translate the good news for people in our society. So I hope that's helpful, and I hope it lays the groundwork for where we're going to go next. So, second question, given the Bible's teaching that all wrongdoing is sinful and worthy of death, why does the church often single out sexual sin for special condemnation? It's a good question. I'd say two things. First of all, Paul kind of talks about the idolatry that leads to being given over to the sinful desires and shameful lusts and a depraved mind, and lists all sorts of things. And there is, I think, a theological sense that, as Paul will say elsewhere in the letter, you break one law, you've broken the law. And therefore you're in trouble in that sense, right? It is worth noting, though, that, and this is true in the church as well, in Jewish thought, there was discussion about what I think they framed it about as the heaviest and the lightest laws. They were all important, but there were some that were heavier and some that were lighter. And I remember I was reading, I can't remember where, but that one rabbi in particular said that the lightest law was the law that says if you find a bird's nest, you can take the eggs, but not the mother, I think is the law. So it's in the law, so we should obey it. But in terms of its weightiness, it's not nearly as weighty as love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, right? So when Jesus is asked the question about what's the most important law, it was a question of the weightiness, right? So he wasn't saying that all the rest aren't important. He wasn't saying that nothing else counts. It's just these two. He was just saying that those were the heaviest of the laws. And so there's always been a recognition that there are some sins, some crimes that are worse than others, right? That's reflected in our wider society, right? In our legal system. We get it. There are some things that are really bad and some things that are not so bad. And I think it's worth noting in terms of the second part of the question, why, the church has focused on sexual sin. Our society focuses on sexual sin, right? Well, they might not call it sin. If I can go back to the first question, that's not how we should translate it for people, right? But sexual crimes are still really, really bad. They are deemed to be amongst the worst of the crimes, right? So part of the scandal around the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing is the trafficking and the covering up of the trafficking. All right, that's part of the that's where the heat is, because we recognize that's just awful. I'm not sure that we ever use the word immoral outside of the church, but it's awful behavior. We recognize that, you know, the sexual assault and the accusations of rape against those schoolboys that's been in the paper the last few weeks, that is just, it's an awful thing, right? So it's not as if the church has been, you know, alone in highlighting sexual sin. I think, though, you know, if I can get at the question as well, I think in lots of ways, like for Paul to some degree, he focuses on the idolatry, and in first century Jewish thought, there was this really strong connection between idolatry and sexual immorality, that those two things went together, that if you became idolatrous, sexual immorality was kind of the end result of that. And I think that for the church, I think we see the sexual sin as kind of an outworking of a whole bunch of other stuff that's gone wrong in our society, right? And I think that's it's also one of the really obvious things, right? It's one of the most significant shifts in terms of social ethics over the last generation. And the shifts in views about human sexuality, the things that are now legal, the way that people speak about or are not allowed to speak about human sexuality. I mean, things have changed a lot in the last 30 or 40 years. And so I think the church has picked up on that, obviously, right? This is one of the most significant shifts in our culture. And so it's not surprising that the church would focus on that. Now, I think if I can come back to the question, you know, the first question about kind of translating some of this, I think one of the challenges that we have when we talk about sexuality is that we are still talking about it primarily in moral terms. And as I said, that's a good thing to do. I think it is a moral matter. But our society isn't listening in terms of morality anymore. That's not the conversation. So often, you know, what we hear now, because of the philosophical assumptions that have shifted over centuries, that have emphasized my identity as being, you know, kind of how, what or who I identify with, right? That my internal reality is the reality. And so we have placed human sexuality and sexual expression to a lesser extent at the very center of humanity. And so when we start talking about sexual practice, we're not just talking about a moral activity or an ethical activity. We're talking about people's identity. We're talking about who they are, who they believe themselves to be. And so the questions of then saying to someone who's hearing identity and we speak about immoral behavior, it just gets mixed up really, really quickly. Like, it's really complicated for people. And I think that's part of our challenge, right? The church often discusses human sexuality from the perspective of morality, because that's how it's couched biblically, not from the perspective of identity as it's now understood. And so how we do that is difficult. So I think in part because human sexuality has become so ingrained as a centerpiece of our human identity, whenever the church speaks about it, it's then amplified, right? It's not quite the same as speaking out against, I don't know, gambling, because people, I mean, while people might say, yes, I'm a gambler, right? It's not nearly the same as identifying as heterosexual or homosexual or whatever the case is. It's not so much of an identity thing. And so we can have the conversation about gambling and whatnot, kind of divorced from identity. That's not so easy. And so I think there's a whole bunch of combinations that mean whenever we speak out against sexuality or speak about sexuality, the voice is amplified because the issue is amplified. And so I think that's part of what we grapple with. And I think, you know, as I said, this is not new. The church has always seen sexuality as important. In fact, you know, you go back in just about any period of time in any civilization, and there was legislation around sexuality. Like the government, whatever the government was kind of in the bedroom. We live in a very unique time when we basically said, get out. And the government's like, okay. But it's been a centerpiece of legislation for a long, long time. Not just in the church, but in society. Not just in Christian societies. Roman society had legislation around sexuality. You know, the ancient Assyrians and Babylonians and Egyptians had regulations and legislation around sexuality. So it's not a new thing to make sexuality and its role in human life so important. Now, Christians can become, I think, single issue people, right? Where it becomes all about one issue rather than broader concerns. And I think that becomes problematic. I think our polarized social media setting means, again, that we very rarely are able to describe or sit in a position that has any nuance to it. And all of that makes it much more difficult when we talk about sexuality to be heard effectively, whether because we're not translating particularly well or because we're tweeting about it rather than actually having a conversation about it or whatever it is. So if I can fall back again on just how complex this whole thing is, and how difficult it is because it interacts with, you know, scripture and tradition and reason and our experience. And all those things kind of combine for us in pretty powerful sorts of ways. Let's move on to the last question. Does Paul's teaching in Romans 1:26-27 mean that all homosexual activity is wrong, even if it's in the setting of a committed monogamous relationship? So I can give you the Twitter answer, but that's not particularly helpful. I'll say it this way. I find it really hard to argue that Paul would be okay with a monogamous homosexual relationship. I just find it really difficult. Now, in part, because that kind of relationship wasn't necessarily known to Paul. I mean, there were certain long-term homosexual relationship, as I understand, in the Greco-Roman world. But I don't think that seems to be the within Paul's, understanding. But the way in which Paul, the way in which Jesus, the way in which the Old Testament describes and talks about sexual immorality more broadly, I just find it really, really difficult to find any really convincing argument to say that a committed monogamous homosexual relationship is fine. I find it really difficult. And that's, you know, that's across the whole of Scripture. Now, having said that, I'm also aware, as I, you know, intimated at the beginning, this is a really important question in our local, in our social context right now. And our society has come to very, very different answers to that question. It's wrapped up now with questions of identity, which makes it far more difficult to talk about that kind of behavior. And you have the pastoral implications of how do we navigate that space. I think a little bit about, you know, what would happen if a same-sex couple who were happily and monogamously married had adopted a couple kids, came to our church exploring faith, and eventually came to faith. What in the world? What in the world would we do in that scenario? And I don't really have a solid answer for it. But I do believe that we would have to be gracious, and we would have to be empathetic, and we would have to, I think, grapple a little bit with what Scripture has to say about sexuality. And I think, you know, I think the big questions. That's not the right answer. That's not the right way to put it at all. I think some of the critiques of the Christian response, I think, have been really, really valid, and I find quite challenging. So, for instance, the idea that the church has been very heteronormative, right? So, essentially, if you are heterosexual, we say next to nothing about your sexual practice, right? And I think that's a legitimate criticism. I think that the church has lost the capacity, but we tend not to talk enough about human sexuality. I think there are reasons for that. It's complicated and all that sort of thing. But we have to remind people that just because they might be heterosexual doesn't mean that their sexual practice is fine, that you're all good. There are all sorts of heterosexual sexual practices that are condemned in Scripture, and we need to remind people about those sorts of things. I think we need to be speaking more broadly about more categories rather than just focusing on one issue and saying that's what's wrong and that's the thing that has to change. I think that, we have tended to, if I can come back to the Romans sermon, we've tended a little bit to do the we play the B-side of the album. We play the wrath of God first rather than listening to the hit of righteousness first, that God is willing to, that God is, has the power to save. And so we end up, and because people hear as identity, and then we speak about what they hear is us speaking about their identity as being wrong and God hates them just because of who they are. And I think that goes beyond what Scripture has to say. I think that goes way beyond what Scripture has to say. And so there are some places where I think our emphasis, and this is where I hope I'm weaving the questions together a little bit. I think some of the way which we have spoken out has been really unhelpful. However, I have a hard time believing that traditional sexual ethics and morality can be set aside if only in the context of a loving relationship. Because there's certain areas that we would say that that's not enough, right? And pedophilia, we don't care if there's love and commitment there, right? We just don't. Now, I'm not saying that that's the same, but there's some analogy to that scenario where we just have to kind of, I think, continue to explore our thinking. And I think this is where our Twitter world ends up getting us into trouble. You take one little phrase or one statement and that becomes the representation of everything you've had to say. I don't think we can get away with that. If I can come back again to the complicated nature of these sorts of questions, I think for the church, I think there is a communication issue about how we speak about these things. And we need to think more broadly about how we do that. I also think that we need to have more conversations, and we need to be reminded about the breadth of what the Bible has to say about sexuality, and we need to be reminded about the ways in which sexuality have been addressed and handled and spoken about by human cultures forever. We are in a very, very interesting time. We are in a very interesting place. And, we end up with all of these really tricky spaces to navigate. Even the language of consent is certainly important, but as the basis for ethics, it's not a really firm foundation, but it's what we've kind of been left with because of the way we speak more broadly about sexuality. So it's certainly an important thing to teach. Misogyny, we need to get rid of that. I think the broader conversations around pornography and its prevalence and its accessibility. There's a part of me that kind of, I read an article yesterday about the Swan scandal that finally, in passing, mentioned pornography. And I thought, now we're getting somewhere. We have this world where we want sexual freedom and we want people to be respectful And sexual freedom has meant that we are allowed to, well, pornography is everywhere. And then we wonder why women are objectified and treated badly. And it's just, there's all these, it's so complicated. It's so complicated. And I'm aware that I don't want to speak. I don't want to speak. I don't want to say more than I ought. And I don't want to say less than I ought. I do think that in all of these questions, that the church has some really big pastoral concerns to address. I think, as I said, I find it difficult to get around the biblical teaching. But I'm also aware that how we go about communicating that and how we go about helping people navigate that space, regardless of whether they identify themselves as heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, or whatever the case is, how we help people navigate that space, how we remind people or how we teach people that, you know, sexuality is a gift from God, but it's not the essence of who we are. Our identity lies elsewhere. We are image bearers of God. And like, there's all these questions that go around with it. And realizing that some of the sexual ethics will sound harsh and unfair and unjust, and that makes the conversation that much more complicated. And so how we navigate that's really tricky. I've been doing quite a bit of reading in this area over the last number of years, some of which you've kind of heard some evidence of here in this. And one of the things that we're looking to possibly do is, I don't know, run a little bit of an opportunity to have some of these wider discussions and kind of think a little bit more broadly about human sexuality in a way that's not quite so heated and allows us a little bit of a framework to have some of those wider conversations. Right. I hope that's been helpful rather than offensive. I hope that's been instructive to kind of frame up some of the wider conversations that we have. Again, let me acknowledge that this is not the best forum for these sorts of conversations. Because it's not a conversation, it's me talking. And so I appreciate the questions. Hope that this has helped advance your own thinking around this a little bit. In part, I hope it's also reminded us of the complicated nature of it. I think one of the ways we have not helped ourselves is that we have basically said, this is really simple, it's all wrong, and that's all there is to it. And that's just not helpful. It's just not helpful. It may have a kernel of truth to it, but it's just not particularly helpful in terms of how we have valuable dialogue, how we interact, and ultimately, you know, how we introduce people to the good news of a God who has sent Jesus and who has given the power to save by faith, first to the Jew and then to the Gentile. As I said, I hope that's helpful. Thank you for those who asked those questions. This coming Sunday, we're in Romans chapter 2. I don't know that we'll pick up too many more of the kind of the aspects of sexuality, although Paul does talk about it in a couple of other places as well. Nonetheless, that's one step forward, maybe, and hopefully not two steps back. Thank you for joining me for the Big Three. I hope you can join me again next week as we continue the conversations around the things that we're learning and engaging with on a Sunday. Until next week, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.